Good morning, everyone. Thank you so
Morning.
much. Thank you so much for waiting for me and doing your good practice while you were waiting. I think I'd like to jump right in this morning, so we'll pay homage to the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas. Incense burning, all space is filled with the fragrance. All Buddhas smell it from afar. Auspicious clouds gather everywhere. With utmost sincerity, all Buddhas appear. We pay homage and offer clouds of incense to the Bodhisattvas and the Mahasattvas. We pay homage, we offer clouds of incense to the Bodhisattvas and the Mahasattvas. We pay homage, we offer clouds of incense to the Bodhisattvas and the Mahasattvas. Thank you. Good morning. So, I hope most of you have attended a workshop or a retreat that I've offered in the past. If not, I think you're in for maybe a rude awakening today because my retreats are very different. I mean, anybody can sit alone and meditate, do their inner work. But when we come together, part of the purpose of coming together is to receive the sublime instructions from the Buddha and his foremost disciples and learn what they mean, how to apply them, and how to put them into action in our lives. We can say we're practicing all the time, but practice doesn't make perfect. Only perfect practice makes perfect. And so we endeavor to establish a more perfect practice so that the actual qualities and the fruit of our practice can walk itself out in our lives. I thank you. I was late today because 20 minutes before the retreat, I got a call from the police and someone had broken into our store. We have a store in the strip mall, and it's really been a blessing to us. We've been closed for a year and 9 months now. But the store has been a blessing. And so when one thing happens, it doesn't erase all the good that has happened. That's just the way our mind works, that ditty that's in our mind. And when one little thing happens, it looms so large in our view that all we can see is that one thing. And then we have such a great aversion to the one thing. But there could have been 99 things that were good and they were better, but we like just throw all our eggs into the basket of that one thing. And so that's how this practice becomes useful for us. I mean, if we can't use it in this Saha world, we can't use it in Samsara to be able to be in this world because we're in this world. I don't think anybody wants to leave before their time. We're in this world, then these practices should be taking us towards how to live in this world with the uncommon peace and with the uncommon wisdom. And so he tells us to do certain things. He says, pay attention, mind is chief. Mind made are we. Whatever we think and ponder on, that becomes the inclination of our mind. And that becomes the world that we see or the lens through which we see and understand everything that's happening in our world. And that sutta goes on to say, he abused me, he beat me, he robbed me. Those who harbor such thoughts in them, anger and hatred will not be appeased. He abused me, he beat me, he robbed me. Those who do not harbor such thoughts in them, anger and hatred will be appeased. So today, I don't want it to happen again, but today was such a wonderful opportunity and beginning of my practice, because I practice too, in putting into and applying the suttas to what's going on right there in my life. And I'm asking you to do the same thing. So when I got a call, the first thought, they said, well, no, this is the police. Your store has been broken into. And I said, oh, no. He said, yeah, we're here now. And can you come up? And I told him I'd be there in 10 minutes, take me 10 minutes to get there. The second thought was, oh, no, I'm not going to be able to start my retreat on time, you know. And then I said, this is my present moment. And I just went up and I talked with the officer, and we did the things we have to do. And they stole one of the cash registers that was queued up for today's opening and some things like that. And he said, you're mighty happy to be going through this. I said, I'm not going through anything. I said, there's a lot of people today, right this minute, going through a lot worse than what I'm going through. And so this is how we have to actually put into practice, not like just spouting, you know, empty theories, but can we walk it out? And if we can't walk it out, then we have not yet approached the Dhamma. For so many years, we've been practicing and still studying, still crazy after all these years, still neurotic after all these years, still troubled by everything after all these years, still depressed after all these years, still angry after all of these years. Still beating ourselves up, not knowing how the suttas explain and show us how to walk out the right kind of efforting. So isn't it about time? Isn't it about time? I wanted to open with a sutta number 145 in the Majjhima Nikaya. And this was the advice that I think somebody's speaker's on. The advice to Punya. In the Majjhima Nikaya Sutta 145. So Punya asked the Buddha, could he take leave? He wanted to leave the community and go wandering. And the Buddha said, well, you can. If you can handle wandering, where will you go? And he named a city that he wanted to go to, or town or whatever. He said, you know, the people, they are fierce and they're rough. If they abuse and threaten you, what will you think? And he said, if they abuse and threaten me, I'll think these people are excellent. They are truly excellent in that they did not give me a blow with the fist. He said, but Punya, what if they give you a blow with the fist? What will you think then? He said, I think, Venerable Sir, these people are excellent, truly excellent, in that they did not give me a blow with a clod. He says, this is how I shall think of them. He said, but Punya, if they give you a blow with a clod, what will you think? He said, well, I will think these people are excellent. They are truly excellent in that they did not give me a blow with a stick. He said, but Punya, if the people there give you a blow with a stick, what will you think then? He said, Venerable Sir, if they give me a blow with a stick, I'll think these people are excellent. They are truly excellent in that they did not give me a blow with a knife. He said, but Punya, if these people do give you a blow with a knife, what will you think then? And he said, Buddha, Venerable Sir, if they give me a blow with a knife, I shall think these people are excellent. They are truly excellent. He said, but what if these people take your life with that sharp knife? He said, then I would think thus. There have been disciples of the Blessed One who, being repelled, humiliated, and disgusted by the body and by life, have sought an assailant. But I have attained an assailant without even search. Then I shall think this. He said, good, Puna. Possessing such self-control and peacefulness, you will be able to dwell in that country. Now it is time to do what you think is fit. Okay. And so I think it's such an excellent sutta because it tells us how to bring our mind to the present moment that understands causality, cause and condition. And if we really understand it like we say we do, then we know that the minute something is being executed, the result is already embedded in it. So that by the time something happens to us, it's not like just happening. It was already in the making simultaneously with its cause. So there's no point in lamenting at this point because it's already happened. It's just a matter of what we shall do now. And that will completely change how you approach the vicissitudes of life and how you will. There's a scripture in the Bible. I love it so much. It says, if I say to myself, I shall put on a happy face, then and only then can my countenance be changed. And so there's a process that we go through in our cultivation whereby we're not looking for any external means of redemption, but that we apply something ourselves. Because no matter how much someone else is there to help us, it doesn't mean that we can use help. You know, my cat loves me. I say it all the time. And he has divine transportation when he has to go somewhere, like to the vet. You know, I know when he's sick. I know when he's hungry, when it's feeding time. I know when he's lonely. You know, he probably thinks I'm a god. So it's okay for him to think that I'm a god. You know, I'm able to meet his need to anticipate what he needs, and he calls on me when he needs me. So there are beings in the world throughout creation in the 10 directions. I know nobody thinks that we're the highest classification of being in all of the universe. If so, I don't know what to say. We might not want to call them ETs because that's a little scary to us, but I'm sure they are extraterrestrials, meaning they're not from here. You know what I mean? And we're scared of anybody who's not from our neck of the woods, even if it's our world, you know, we get scared. But not only are there beings that, you know, manifest from light places and from dark places, there's some that live here that we can't see, just like I can't see germs. But if I come into contact with them and I have a cut on my skin, it gets in my bloodstream, then I might not know what it is, but I know I have been invaded by something I cannot even see. And so we have to broaden our perspective. It's the narrowness that traps us up and wraps us up and keeps us from actually entering into the truth of the Dhamma. So I'm saying to you that there is a way to approach and access the Dhamma. There is a way to practice it, and it is through our own cultivation. Now, there's slow methods, there's quick methods, and people say, oh, well, if you want to do Theravada, that's the slow method. Okay. And if you want to do Mahayana, that's the quick method. And if you want to do Vajrayana, that's the super quick method. But you know what got me interested in Buddhism? Because I was searching for something. You know, I was already happy when I came. So they've been trying to get that happiness out of me. Like, that's a lost cause. I was looking for something even greater than what I already had. I didn't leave it because I was disgusted with it. I left that particular spiritual path because I believed what I read. I had experienced these things directly for myself that I read about. So I knew them to be true. But when I looked around me in general, you know, I felt like I had hit a glass ceiling, because every Sunday we were back at church groveling at the altar, or maybe every Sunday we back for a Dhamma talk, you know, but I was groveling at the altar and everybody's crying out, "I'm looking for a miracle." You know, I said one day, I said, "God, why is it that I'm always looking for a miracle?" I said, how come I can't learn to keep myself? Jesus wasn't running around looking for a miracle. So there's something missing in how the story has filtered down and how the directions have filtered down, that it's left a little impotence there. And I'm looking to find the answers, you know, to how to be truly content and successful in life in the right sense of what success is, so the kind of success that has no sorrow with it. So I got what I call a signal, a message. I get something inside, and it said, if you want to know what a master meant, don't ask his disciples. They don't know. They're trying to figure it out. Go ask another master. So I started searching for a master. And I not only encountered one, I've encountered four over the course of my life. And they have helped me to be able to understand these things from a different side, because they have entered into, you know, the fullness of it. And that's why a teacher is so important, you know. And the Buddha said that when you're teaching, you know, don't just go by, you know, the tradition or what the tradition says. Don't just go by what your teacher said. Don't go by what you've heard, he said, but take what you heard. He didn't say discount it right off the top. You know how we are, like, if that doesn't jive with how we roll, how we think, and how we're feeling, like, we just reject that right off hand. So if you're rejecting right off hand, then what's the point in even taking it up? What's the point in even investigating? What's the point in even looking? He said that we should not just reject something offhand. We should also not just take it in as a truth, but he said that we should do something. We should put it into the cauldron of our experience. We should try it and see if it works. And if it doesn't work, then he said, you can just set that one aside. And sometimes it's not because it doesn't work for everybody. It just doesn't work for you with your particular mind stream, with your particular experiences, even with your particular personality. If another's personality has to be like your personality for you to get along with them. You see, so there are many things that come in to play around us being able to apprehend or realize a truth. And so he says that they say that he gave 84,000 teachings, or they call it 84,000 Dhamma gates by which one can enter. Doesn't mean we try to enter all 84,000, but a rose by any name is still a rose. So find the doorway for you, the one that you can step through, and you begin working with that. And remember that the one you step through may not be the one that your partner steps through, or that your friend steps through, you know. So sometimes we have to walk this journey alone, according to our own peculiarities and propensities, until we get into an open field where we find like-minded people who understand the language that we speak. Until sometimes we hear something five different ways because each way left out some little missing piece for us. And so it hindered our understanding. Once we've heard it this way and from this perspective and from this perspective and from this one, and then we're like, oh, I got it. And this is actually this. That's the thing about whenever you're on a good spiritual path, one that is useful, one that is beneficial, one that is it's the way leading upward the Buddha said, and they all seem to be called the same thing, the way. And Taoism called the way, and Christianity called the way, and Buddhism called the way, or the path. So there's some language that's universal, because it implies something that ones can touch and connect with, you know, regardless of which route they took to get there, you know. So I'm saying all this to say to you, don't let Dhamma or Buddha Dhamma to you simply become an academic exercise, something that you can talk about, something that you can intellectualize around. But it is an actual path for living that catapults us out of a seat of blindness and pain to true acceptance, being truly in the present moment, understanding that the present moment is the result of moments before it, and that the die is already cast. So it's not so much how to handle the present moment. It's more of having a mind bent toward how I want to influence what has not already happened. So in other words, what I want for the next moment. If I was full of anger or fear or depression just in some kind of a unbeneficial state of mind that's rising in this moment, I don't want the next moment to be just like this one. So what will I do differently in this moment that will set up a different fruit or result in the next moment? So the police officer said, I've never seen people that are so happy. You know, like when I respond to a robbery, they're upset, they're angry, they're cursing, they're fearful. Did I lose some money today? Yes, I did. I did. But it's already gone. You know, so it's no point in me worrying about that. There were so many days, every day since the day we opened, we made money. We didn't lose money. I can't tolerate losing money one day. So yes, they stole one of the cash registers, but guess what? I have two cash registers. So I could open, you know, my staff could open at 10 o'clock and we're back to business as usual. I can't get a door put in, but I'll just go at the end of the day and have two sheets of plywood and a bolt put through them so I can close it up until Monday when they can replace the glass. You know, they could have stolen more than they did, but they just did a smash, grab and run, I guess. You know, so I had there were $600 bicycles, three lawnmowers. They were, you know, they were big ticket items sitting right there. But they didn't get that. They got the cash register. So I laughed. The first thing I said to the officer, I said, oh, so it must have been one of my customers. Because I have two cash registers here, but I usually only have one open. The second one, we rarely have to open because, you know, we're building the business. And so we don't do that much that we need both of them open. Our lines are not that long. There's somebody comes in here all the time. They know it's only money in this register, you know, and I just laughed at it. I mean, that's just samsara. That's how things go. And all I needed to know was, what do I need to do to be able, can y'all finish y'all, wrap up y'all's investigation? This shouldn't take too long. It shouldn't take you any longer than the people who came in and stole this stuff, okay? Y'all been here a long time, and I got a retreat I got to get to. And that was it. And so he said, well, you know, they dropped something, part of the cash register. I got one of the $3,000 systems, you know. Now I'm going to get a $200 cash register to replace it. But I have three, and it has, you know, like iPad with it, and everything is electronic, you know, and it just sends the credit charges directly to the bank. I mean, it's nice, but I'm not buying another one. And I just, he said, but they dropped a piece of it, and we got it, and they have fingerprints on it. So he says, we think we can get it. And he says, do you have cameras? I said, I'm not sure, because when they were asking me, did I want cameras? I said, you know, this is a liquidation store. I'm not going to send somebody to jail for stealing a $10 item or a $20 item, because I don't think that jail is restorative. I said, when they have a better system for helping people to stop doing evil, then I'll think about it a little bit more. I said, but for $10, $20, $50, I'm not going to do that. And I had started with a junk store, $10 store, but now I have these big expensive items. So I was thinking, oh, and I didn't get that camera, did I? You know, but when we called today, they said, yeah, you do. You have you did activate the cameras. And so the police is taking the role, and that's it. But even if they didn't have the fingerprints, even if, and I never think if somebody steals from me, it's their first time stealing, right? So they're probably in a system somewhere. But even if they were not in a system, even if, and I have no sense that I'll recover, you know, the opening drawer, the money that was, you know, that doesn't matter. All I've been thinking about is what a good day this is. And I would get to be back with my Dharma friends, you know, and I actually had a lesson today that goes just with my Dharma talk. Be careful what you wish for, you know. But there was a lesson that went right with my Dharma talk. And this is how we can approach life. No, regardless of what it is, whether it's praise or blame or loss or gain or pleasure or pain or shame and fame, those are the eight worldly winds. All eight, we have to be able, you know, to accommodate in our life. And I can tell you the four that sound good, you know, when we're talking about winning, you know, and we're talking about pleasure, praise and blame, when we're talking about praise, when we're talking about fame, those seem like such good things, right? But how many famous people do you know that, you know, just commit suicide or drug themselves to death? You know, there's something that goes with all of these things. The Buddha said that when my mind is down or in a negative place and depressed, it's agitated. He said, but when my mind is jubilant and joyous over the things of the world, the mind is still agitated. He said, now there is a pleasure, I say to you, that is not born from this world, not born from the things of this world. He said, now I don't say that you shouldn't find or take up or hold or abide in that pleasure, but not the pleasure from the things of this world, because they're temporary. He said, everything and everybody that we encounter in this world, we're going to be separated from at some point. And so it takes time for us to recognize our attachment to things, and that our attachment to them is what causes us the most suffering, that causes us the most trepidation, that causes us the most fear, even down to the notion of this individuated I, this self that we think of sort of as a permanent self. I know we all know we're not going to live forever. We just think, I'm not going to die today. And because we think that, you know, we count on being alive today, and we cling to that identity, that personality, and we call it us. And the Buddha says that he doesn't say that there is, some people say, because, you know, you have to read a lot, 84,000 Dharma gates, remember? And some, he's talking about this non-self or this no-self, there's not a self to be found. But when one of his disciples started going around just teaching, I said, no, that's not true. He said, when did I ever give a teaching like that? You know, He said, you didn't understand the whole teaching. He said, it's neither this nor this. That's why his teaching is called the middle way. There's some place we have to get with our understanding that we don't concretize around any particular view. And so, sure, I'm talking to you right now. I'm really right here in this chair. I assure you that I am. And I'm pretty sure that you're right there. You know, but not holding myself and not holding you in a certain way allows for there to be an association, a relationship that can have no sorrow with it. And so when he talks about non-self, and we talk about a conventional view and we talk about an ultimate view, you know, but we don't even have to divide it into ultimate and conditional. It's more like this. Here's a glass of water, and the water is clear, right? And if I hold it up, well, I have kind of one of those bubbly glasses, but if I'd had just a very clear, smooth glass, I could look right through this glass and I see you. So at the in the center or at the core of this glass, it's just clear. And through this, I see things. I see everything. And if I were holding it right here looking, I'd be looking at everything through this lens of clarity, clear glass. But if I put Kool-Aid in it, and the Kool-Aid stains or colors the water, and then I hold it up and try to look, I wouldn't be able to see. And so misperceptions that are conditioned by ignorance or lack of understanding of the true nature of reality is something like that. It's like the glass with Kool-Aid. And what the Dharma does, it's like about 40 years ago, how old am I, 50 years ago, I used to sell Amway, and we had a special product called, I think it was called Renews or Renews It or something like that. And when we'd have a house party and we pull out our products, we'd save this product for last. You know, we give them something, you put it right here. Oh, no, that was Melaleuca. You put that on. If you have a migraine, it takes your headache away immediately. But anyway, they had many, many good products. Might have been expensive, but because we all had to get paid. But there were, and after we went through all those products, we would pull out the very last, our best product. And it was this Renews It. And we'd take a glass of water. And, of course, we'd sip the water, good water. Then we put a little bit of red dye number 2 in it. And everybody, if you're over, say, 45 or 50, you'll remember red dye number 2. If you got that on your clothes, forget about it. You just tied, didn't get that out. You might as well just throw the blouse away or whatever. But we would put that red dye number 2 in the glass and stir it up. Then we take a little bit of our Renews It and put it in the glass and stir it. And before their very eyes, like magic, but not magic, because there were certain properties that made it so, the water would clear up and it would turn back clear. And just to show you how harmless this was, then we drink some more of the water, because you could even drink the water. The Renews It didn't harm you. And then everybody would sign up, you know, because to sell that product, because it was such a fantastic demonstration. And the Dharma says, let me demonstrate to you the nature of reality and the truth that one can enter into, so that there would be nothing in this life, not even death, that could shake our confidence and our capacity to walk through this life successfully. Isn't that what you want? I mean, I love all the things we do. Some people are deep into devotion, and I'm one of those kind. You know, I just from the time I discovered church when I was 13, I was just like deep into a devotional thing. Drove my family crazy. They started locking the door so that I couldn't leave to go to church because they weren't living that good, and they didn't even want me to know so much of the right way. So they would get upset and told me I was going to be a religious fanatic, and I would have to sneak out. My brother would sneak me out my bedroom window and go off to church in the evening, come back and sneak me back in the window. And so there were these times that I was always thinking, how could I be happy in the world? I was in a dysfunctional family. My youngest sibling was 5 years older than me, and they were all 1 year apart, and it was six of them, and then I had two cousins living there, and two somebody else's. I think they were aunts. I don't know. You know, in those days, you didn't even really know who your whole family was. You just knew the story. Somebody had to die before you found out the truth about some things. But there we were, all of us, I think it was 12 of us, living all together in a two-bedroom house. Four of us slept in one bed, and they didn't have king-size beds in those days. So we slept across the bed instead of like head to foot, so that four of us could fit, four kids could fit on a bed. I thought everybody lived like that. You know, so I was happy with a house full of people. And I was happy to have, you know, sisters and brothers, but they weren't so happy with me because I just wasn't like, you know, I wasn't their age. You know what it's like when you have the last one and it's the baby. And I was my father's, they all had one father, and I was my father's only child. He was my mother's second husband, and they loved him. They called him the man because when he came into their life, he brought some prosperity to their life. They had been placed in a foundling home. That's what we called them then. When her husband left, she couldn't afford to take care of them. And he left them at a train station. I'm telling you sad stories, because when you start wanting to tell your story, what I'm telling you is everybody got one. And so he had left them all at a train station, and the police got them. And when they called her, she came to get them, they said, and they wouldn't let her have them. They said, you can't afford to take care of them by yourself. So within a year, she had married my father, and he was able, because of his financial condition, to get them out and create a true home life for them. But he was in his 50s. And he thought, okay, he lived a swashbuckling life, and he never wanted children. But now he was getting old, and he regretted that he never had children. He made a pact with my mom. He said, I want to have a family. And so I will marry you and get your kids out so that I can also have a family. And that's what he did. But now I come along a year later, and he never thought he'd have a child. And so, of course, you know, I was a spoiled brat. I didn't realize I was spoiled. I'm just being me, you know, ask for what you want. Yeah. There's a training program, a management training program that said, you don't get what you deserve. You get what you negotiate. Now that I am a Buddhist practitioner, I have changed my view about that somewhat, you know, and that's the good thing for me. So going into business and being into banking, and that's what they taught you. Don't get what you deserve. You get what you negotiate. I had a certain mindset when I came in, but the Dharma changed and washed that mind, you know, so that I, in living for other beings, the first step is to consider others equal with oneself. And what that means is that if I have the upper hand, if I have the advantage, I don't want to take advantage of anyone. That's the way the Dhamma cleans up the mind if we do perfect practice. And today and tomorrow, we're going to be discussing perfect practice. So you need to be taking notes, because we're going to be breaking out into some groups, and we're going to have a chance to talk and express. And I'm asking you to really be here with me, to really, really focus. And I know that most of us have our cameras off. You know, I have my camera on because I'm wanting to dialogue with you. And this is the best that we can do it right now, is over Zoom. But how would you feel if my camera was off our whole dialogue? It would make you feel like we're not really here together with each other. And so I'd like for you to consider turning your camera on. Now, my room is a little junky, so my camera's turned around so you can't see how junky. I guess you can't see. Let me make sure you can't see in this mirror. How's that? Better? Make sure you can't see how junky my room is. But I do certainly want, you know, to be making eye contact with you. And to get a body feel, you know, and being able to use my sense gates helps me with that. Okay, so that's all I'm going to say about that. And you have free will, so you can do whatever you like. But that's how it would be a supportive for me. So when we take up a study, and usually we enter the path according to what's where we think we're suffering, or how we think or what we think will bring us out of the ways we currently feel, you know, or the ways we currently hold life. And for a lot of Westerners, just due to our culture, and I won't say exclusively Westerners, because I can't imagine people being any more stressed out than the people who live in the East. Okay. Yes, they bombed us 9/11, but there's some places where for the last 20 years, ever since a person has been born, they've been subject to bombing and destruction and carnage every single day. So when I am considering others like myself, or exchanging self with others, the second step of the process, you know, I'm not thinking more highly of myself than I think of someone else, whether they're near, like family versus stranger, or whether they're near, like this country versus afar. And so it allows me to look more definitely at causality. So karma is nothing more than cause and condition. Some of you may have heard it if you were in the church as sowing and reaping, but that got so abused that we can't even talk about sowing and reaping. The other part of it is that everything is not just what we do, because we're with other people. So if I'm with other people and they do something, I might just be in the right place, but it must have been the wrong time, you know? Or we know that there is something that brought us to that intersection at that time. And so either something we need to reflect on, or it's something that we need to accept because the die is already cast and we find ourselves here, either way. And we can reflect and see if there's something that we could do differently in the next moment. And we can do it like maturely. We can do it through simple observation. But if we're so attached to our views, we're so attached to how we think it ought to be, we're so attached to like loving oneself more then you love others, not equal with others. And you could say, well, I love my wife that way. I love my husband that way. I love my children that way. But from the seat I sit in, which is I get everybody's story, I know that that's not so. We love them today when they're doing the things that we want, or when we think we have the things, they have the things that we want, and we'll work about changing them later. I can change him. And we try, and that doesn't work out for us. And then we're like, I'm tired of this. I'm not putting up with that. It was like, this is how I was when you met me. Yeah, but I thought I could change it. Or maybe I changed. And maybe what was acceptable to me because of how I held myself or thought about myself, maybe the low expectation I had for a relationship because I didn't have the right view about myself. Or maybe because I want to save everybody. I have a desire to, but don't have the skills. And then we find ourselves reaping the results of the totality of our understanding. And so we have to get understanding. Knowledge and understanding are not the same thing. It takes, they call Buddha's disciples the analyzers. They also call them the happy ones. And I used to be Pentecostal, and we were long dressed, black hat wearing church folk, that never smiled and, always judging somebody, condemning somebody, including ourselves. And I'm not saying all Pentecostals like that. I'm just saying our brand of Pentecostalism was like that. The only time we were happy was when we were singing songs about the Holy Jesus and in the Spirit with the Holy Ghost. Then we could like flip over tables, break up chairs, put your hands on a hot radiator, not even get burned, fall out, hit your head on the floor, not even a bump. No, but could walk right out that church and somebody step on your shoe, your suede shoes coming out of church, because we used to dress up. I mean, we seriously dressed up then. And step on your shoes and you'd be ready to punch them out. But that's that imperfect kind of practice. That's a kind of cultivation that either that is lacking in that it leaves all the work on somebody else. Like, we can't get along. I need you to be different. We're not seeing eye to eye. You need to understand my point of view. Or I have opinions and I have a right to make you listen to my opinion. And if you look at where we are in the world today, it's all around those things. And we see the trajectory and where it's taking us. And sometimes, we say them, people out there have just gone mad, But we don't have to, scratch too far beneath the surface before we encounter that same kind of mind. And before we find ourselves acting just like those people that we talk about. Because, of course, our view is the right view. And if you don't have my view, then you have the wrong view. And some things, I'm not saying that it's not some things that are just wrong. Some things are just evil. If you want to go from unbeneficial to downright evil, that's on a trajectory. But I'm saying that 90% of the ills, 95 maybe even down to the devastation and destruction around our climate, around our denatured food, that we don't even have healthy, you know, you are what you eat. Our food's all denatured, so our brain elevator's not even going all the way up. You know, but when we see the conditions, there's a particular mind that created most of these conditions. And we can't fix these conditions with the same mind that created them. That's it. That's it. Now, we can make things better, and that's what we should try to do. A bodhisattva is one who hears the cries of the world and responds with compassion and power. Not just with compassion, because you can have compassion and you have absolutely no ability or capacity or skills to help with something. Then you're making a matter even worse, trying to be helpful. So get some skills and then go help. Or take up the slack for someone who has the skills so that they can go help. We can always find some way to participate in goodness. And the thing is that we have to think that goodness has a benefit and that goodness has power. You know, bad folks, you know, are more they have more confidence in badness than good folks have in goodness. Could you hold on one quick second for me, Jack? Before we do a thing, while we're doing it, to see if we're doing it with the same motivation, then after we've done it. Because that after a while, that hindsight will produce foresight and will give us insight. Now, insight can't be read and adopted from a book, and not even from just sitting on a pillow, but it's from walking out the conclusions that we come to conclusions by walking out what we intellectually assent to. Doesn't mean that we have perfected the practice of it, the execution of it. We like just agree that's a good way to be, you know, but we may never be that way if we don't walk it out. He said, if you come up with an action and you start and you get in the middle of it and you're reflecting and like, maybe this wasn't such a good idea, then he said, you could stop. Just stop right there. Oh, but what will people think if I stop? Oh, what does this mean? I'm so attached to it. This is me. You know, I am my badge. I am my robe. I am my, you know. And then we're far from the path or the way leading upward. And instead, at the end of it, reflect again, or sometimes afterwards, and see if you still feel the same way. Was it good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good at the end? And that's how we will begin to gather and insights and how to meaningfully and how to seize the essence of this precious human life. He said, before you say a thing, apply these same three again. You know, does it need to be said? Does it need to be said right now? Am I the one to say it? Are they in any condition to hear it? If I feel like I just got to tell you, you know, and I tell you, but it takes you further away from being able to accommodate or use or accept the point that I'm trying to make, then is there a point to going ahead and say? And if you've asked yourself these questions, you know, am I the one? Is this the right time? Are they in a position to hear? You know, are they listening right now? Can I deliver it in a way that is not judgmental, that is cordial, you know, that is non-accusatory, even if I need to point out something, you know, can I do that? Do I have the skill to do that? You know, and if I think I do, then it's allowable. I should perhaps say it. But while I'm in the middle of saying it, if my old mind starts creeping back in, like, and yeah, and I want her to know this too. You know how you start with something, you know, I'm going to say this as gently as I can, but then you think about something that person did that's right around this conversation you need to have. And this is not the first time, this is the fifth time. And actually, you know, you're going to have to change your behavior if you still want to be here. Before you know it, it's not in the way that it originally came up when you were asking the question, am I the one to say it? Is now the time? Do I have the skills? Will it, is this be beneficial? Do I think, sometimes we think it'll be beneficial and it turns out to be a disaster. But I'm talking about intention. And so yes, then you should say it. And then after you've said it, go back and reflect. How was that? Was I skillful? Did I think it was useful? Sometimes we have a burning desire to let folk know something, you know, but afterwards you could see once you got it off of you like a hot coal, here, I throw that off on you. And once you got it off of your chest, then, like, I really didn't have to say that. I really didn't have to say that. And so this is how we train. So when we are meditating, like if we look at the Anapanasati Sutta, it's designed to do something. And yes, we can use it on the pillow, but we're always breathing in and out. So we can be always training, right? Now he said, before you think a thought, and I used to wonder now, how are you going to do that? Before you think a thought. But he tells us how. He tells us how to condition our mind in such a way that an unwholesome thought won't arise. But if we missed it, then when it does arise, how to subdue it? He tells us how to keep good thoughts always abounding in the mind so that when something comes, it won't throw us off. And how to keep something good in the mind so that after a while, certain thoughts won't even come. They just go look for a new house. They just abandon you, you know. And so he says, keep unarisen, unwholesome states from arising by sweetening the mind, looking at what we think about and ponder on, you know. There's many methods that we can use. That's all you know, chanting is, or singing certain songs, or, you know, getting a certain image or picture in your mind and concentrating on it. Like a laser beam, like a focus. And then what you'll find is that once you have focused sufficiently, you know, it becomes anchored. In the Bible, they say that word have I hidden in my heart, O Lord, that I won't sin, you know, that I won't miss the mark. And so it's something like that. You see, when we take a vow, we're taking a vow to ourselves. Others might benefit. When I take a vow to not do this or not do that or to do this or to do that, I'm doing it for my own sake, because everything we do for ourselves. Other people might benefit from it, or other people might encounter difficulties because of it. But really, when one makes a vow to themselves. Let me take a look at the time. Okay, so I've been talking for 1 hour, and I think, do we need a break? I don't think I have my screen set up in a way, like I don't see you all. I just see like 5 people across the top. Is that something that I adjust myself?
Venerable, if you change it to gallery view, you should be able to see everybody.
Okay.
So that's depending on what you're on, it could be up in the view in the upper right hand corner if you're on a computer.
I am.
Okay, so there's a little view button. There should be anyway.
Okay, and I hit view and put myself on gallery.
Gallery, yeah.
And then how wonderful.
Yay. I know, isn't that great?
It's truly great. I usually have somebody here with me doing this. Okay. So I think we should take a little break, but I want to set us up for coming back and give the technician a few minutes to set up the groups, however we can do those groups. And what I'd like for us to think about is how well we're doing with that one method or instruction from the Buddha about thinking about a thing before one thinks it. Before a thought grows out of the mud of your mind. And what did he say do? So how could one put one's mind in a particular position that, that bad thoughts cannot arise, fearful thoughts cannot arise. I want to know how you do that. And I'm going to give you a chance to talk with each other about saying a thing. And of course, if mind is chief and we're thinking certain things, ultimately we're going to say them out of our mouth, whether they like whether we blurted out or whether we didn't mean to say it. Or I remember when I used to work a job, I'd be at the water cooler. I was always at the water cooler because at the water cooler was where everybody talked about everybody. And who got talked about? The one who wasn't at the water cooler at the time. So I made sure that whenever I saw a gathering at the water cooler, I was there too. You know, but I was really starting to try to do, to change, to be different, you know. And one day someone asked me, well, what do you think about so-and-so? Like, we weren't gossiping, like we were just talking, you know, because this was a real incident that had happened. And, you know, it sort of affects us. And we were like, well, what do you think about this? And I had a little history with the person, right? And we were okay right now. We're on good terms and everything. And that was a long time ago anyway. And, you know, so I just like, I started off good, like giving her the benefit of the doubt. But the more I talked, the more my history rose up and I remembered some things. And before I knew it, halfway in what I wanted to share, it was like, you know how you throw in shade, but just in such a, it's like subterfuge, like you, they don't even see that you're really talking about it. You're saying, be careful, watch out for her, because I had an encounter with her and she did this, you know. And I said, well, you know, like maybe, like I remember one time when we had a run-in, you know, and I'm talking about it in a good way. But the more I talked about it, the more I was really, you know, casting dispersion on her. And I stopped, and then I recognized it because I'd been doing this practice. I recognized, and I said, oh. I said, wait a minute. I said, I'm gossiping. I need to go sit down. And I asked them to forgive me. Now, that messed me up bad. Because, first of all, they like, okay, now she can't be trusted because she's getting a conscience. That's number one. So I got to be careful what I say to her. And then number two, you know, if you want to do bad or do wrong, you don't want everybody to know. You know, so now I just had to put it out there because I was trying so hard to do the right things and say the right things. And I just said, you know, I'm trying to do something different. And you don't want to let everybody peep your whole card. Just do differently. You don't have to say you're trying to do differently. Just do differently. See what I mean? Some things is better for people not to know because then they try to put you to the test. Yeah, well, I bet you I can get her. You know, I know her. I know she's like this. And so and then we really are going to break. I had a Sangha member and he hadn't been at the Sangha for about a year or even 2 years. you know how they like fall in for a while and then fall out for a while. Like, I'm happy to see you come and happy to see you go because I'm not attached in a certain way. Yes, I care, but I care enough for me and you not to create a stickiness so that a person can't do what they feel they need to do for themselves. I'm not doing no calls and calling people, where are you? Haven't seen you at, you know, at Dharma lately. You're free to come if you want to come. And if you need me, you know you can call me. So I'm not going to badger you. I'm not going to send you no, we missed you cards and things like that. You know, but I'm going to let you know when you are with me that I absolutely love you unconditionally. And you can come to me with something because, you know, I'm going to tell you the truth. And if I said something that turned out not to be the truth, even if I'm not going to hide it, I'm going to come back and say, you know, like, I wasn't right about that. I was really thinking this. If I think that won't hurt your feelings too bad. If I think that hurts your feelings too bad, then I won't say that, but I will do better next time. You know, so that's how we practice, you know, just being sort of in that middle stream, not flagellating ourselves when we mess up, but really clearly seeing it and acknowledging that that doesn't meet up to the standard that we want to walk out. That's all, you know. And so he had been gone for about 2 years, and then he came back. And I had changed so much over the 2 years. He said, where'd the other Paniwadi go? I said, oh, you mean that vampire, Diane vampire that kept rising up from time to time? I said, I put a stake in her heart, you know. He said, well, I think I like the old one better. And I'm like, goodness, was I that bad? You know, I just wondered because I think I'm still pretty bad now. You know, I'm still working. I'm still working on myself, you know. Not with a lot of judgment, but with clarity. I know me. I mean, like, we all know ourselves, right? You know, we make other people, we try to put up a different face for others. And sometimes we get so confused, we try to put up a different one for ourselves. We paste somebody else's picture on the mirror, look in it and say, that's me. You know, that's what happens if we start believing our own lies. That's why the Buddha said, if you lie, then you're just done for. Because after a while, you'll trick your own mind and you'll believe your own lies. But if we stay humble and we stay truly wanting to know the truth, then we can know it. So let's take, it's 12:36, 46. You might as well just let me talk for 6, 7, 8, 9, for 4 more minutes. And then we'll take a 20-minute break you're on a different time and meet at the hour. Come back at the hour after a 20-minute break. How will that be? And when you come back, I don't like to pre-frame you too much because then you spend your whole break thinking about what you're going to say when you come back. So I won't even tell you what we're going to do. I'll just wait until you come back and I'll tell you then so that it can be spontaneous. You know, this is all about learning how to live spontaneously in the world. That's what helps us to be more authentic. We do too much planning, too much. You know, programming, too much laying it all out. And then we have to try to live up to it, you know, and it becomes a little bit contrived. You know, we lose the ability to respond in the moment with as much integrity because we got stuff at stake. Our reputation's at stake. You know, we how people look at us or think about us. And we start thinking about that. Well, I would say it this way. No, I don't want to say it this way. I'll say it this way, you know, but we have to learn how to say it, you know, and then some of us have to learn how to hear it, you know, and not take it personally. I mean, like, because whatever you say, you're saying that out of your own mind, even if it's something about me. Well, that's what you think. What does that have to do with me? Honestly. Unless what you say is true. If what you say is true, then I need to look at that. If it's not true, then I don't. Everything's not great in Buddha land either. No, I have a group of nuns and their lineage is super legalistic, you know, and they try to follow every letter of the law, you know, but the laws are for the lawless. The Buddha didn't come up with these things for the people who are abiding in a purity of heart. He came up for the renegades, for the lost and lost, and for the lawless. So there is a spirit of the law that is more truthful than the letter of the law. But they believe in the letter of the law. And I'm going to tell you, the spirit of the law part is lacking. And so they always have a problem with me. And mostly because I don't smile sweetly, hold my hands folded all the time and think dastardly thoughts, but look really, really holy and spiritual. You know, like what you see is what you get. And so so that makes our relationship difficult. And they were saying something, we're doing something together, because we do need to come together and for some things. And it's been so difficult. Boy, I've really been practicing, I tell you the truth. But last night, after 2 weeks of back and forth with them, one sister wrote me, and she said, I just want to thank you so much for how you keep trying with us. And I said, she already knows something wrong, but she's with them. She said, I can't speak up for you because I got to live with these people, right? So I get that. I'm not expecting her to. But, you know, it was encouraging to me in my walk because it made a difference. Okay, I think I need to break. I can cut off. See, though, see there, Marilyn? I can cut when I need to cut. All right, so we're going to take a 20-minute break, get some water, stretch your back. Don't think about Dharma right now. Just smell the roses or whatever, and I'll see you in 20 minutes.